Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of Deep Dive, I'm joined by Ron Wakari. Ron is a professor in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at Simon Fraser University in Canada, where he founded the Everyday Design Studio. And in addition, he is a professor and chair of design for the More Than Human-Centered Worlds in the Futures Everyday Cluster in Industrial Design at Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands. He's also the author of the book, Things We Could Design for More Than Human-Centered Worlds, and that's where we'll be spending most of our time for the purposes of this conversation. But it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for joining me, Ron. How are you?
I'm great, and I really appreciate the invitation. Really happy to be here.
I love when guests are happy because that means we're going to have a really good conversation. And I always say this, so people who listen to the show are going to be tired of me saying this, but it's true every time. Like, I'm excited to have this conversation with you because your work captures a lot of what I think people are wrestling with, not only in the sort of traditional, quote unquote traditional, because your book also goes to great lengths to chip away at our notions of traditional, but I'm using these terms just as kind of layman terms for right now. It's not only what folks in traditional design spaces are interested in exploring, but I think I see these questions that you pose in the book in many other disciplines. These ideas of what is our role as human beings in the world that we inhabit? To what extent do we affect that? In what ways do we do that? Good, bad, and indifferent? And are we part of something that we are also observing and changing, right? So there's like a bunch of stuff that kind of had my mind in a twist, right? Because the book reads more like philosophy than straight design, even though it has those elements. And I think the way I read it was that was done on purpose, right? So I kind of gave us a long runway, but I want to give you a chance to at least start with an explanation of what brought you to this particular focus and the writing of the book. And then we'll kind of probably go in a million different places from there.
So first of all, I want to say what a beautiful runway you paved there. I mean, I really think that's a great take. I mean, you know, without even getting into the specifics, but the feel, I think, to get at the motivation to, you know, understand, you know, I think, give a kind of really nice way of understanding why the book was written and how it connects to others who I think have similar issues and why. Yeah, you know, in some ways, I really felt like, I mean, the intro to the book, for those people who haven't read it, is thinking through the idea of more than human. How do we design in more than human worlds? And to take seriously this notion of, as best as I can, so within my capacity, to take seriously this idea that we live in a world in which human values, human goals, human aims, it's not the only important thing. And in fact, we're doing great injustices and we're creating great harm by having this kind of human exceptionalism. And as a designer, design researcher, I did want to strip it down to the basics of what does it mean to be human in this multi-species, more than human world, firstly, and then see design through that prism, through that lens. And it wasn't in a vacuum. You know, I think, you know, in many ways, I think about, you know, I'm also a big role as a design educator and think about the students who I see after they've graduated, who we've trained to be designers. We've trained to say they're empowered to change the world. We've trained them to think they're on this kind of technological edge in which they're going to transform everything. And they come back and say, is this it? They can't, the incompatibilities of some of the goals that we have, not just in design, but many other disciplines, with the urgencies that we hear about, talk about, whether that be climate change, whether that be, you know, what we actually mean by human, who the social and, you know, racial inequities all around that. So anyway, these were kind of like urgent issues. Now, having said that, I wrote from a position where I did not know. You know, and I wasn't, I mean, there was certainly work in my own research that led me to this rethinking human-centered design and rethinking a lot of the assumptions about human-centered design. But I really wanted the book to be an exploration for myself and to challenge myself and my own research and my own thinking to get out ahead of myself. And so I always tried to come back to, yeah, what are, like, I think you put it so beautifully. I mean, it was really was about what does it mean to cohabit this world? And then the vehicle by which I would explore that is design. And in part, I had to get out of, I felt I really had to rethink design. That's why I became so philosophical. I have a love of philosophy. I think that's pretty obvious. And then my own work has become increasingly philosophical in a concrete design research way, but we'll talk about that later.
I do also have a love of philosophy, and not that the academic piece of that matters, but it was a part of what I studied when I was in school, you know, as an undergrad. And it's interesting to me how when you are working in spaces that are considered technical, for lack of a better word, no matter what that space might be. In my case, it was finance when I first got out of school. In others, it could be design, as in the space you work in, or it could be anything that is considered, you know, kind of the hard sciences.
Yeah.
There's such a like desire to draw that line in the sand between the philosophical or the metaphysical or whatever you want to define that is, and like the things that are based in reality, quote unquote reality, the tangible things. And this was not in my notes to ask, but since philosophy kind of came up, because I think it is so central to the, not just your work, but it's so central to the world that we live in, that one of the challenges I've always had as a person, so I'd be curious as another person who seems to wrestle with these things, I always found it almost impossible to separate the two.
Yeah.
The long way of getting to that, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, it seems so essential, but yet people want to dismiss it as if you're just sitting under a tree, you know, waiting for Godot or something, right? And it's
like, exactly.
Yeah. And it's not, I feel like it's not that. Like, I don't know. I feel like if you don't wrestle with these other things, you can't do the other stuff.
Yeah, you know, I mean, on the one hand, you understand the practical, okay, I mean, you know, the practical argument goes like this. We do the hard stuff. That is, we work with empirical stuff. We work with what we can see. You know, that's where we can get data. That's where we can test. As we know, we can make predictions or whatever it might be. There's that. But on the other hand, there's like, I'll speak of technology researchers, the field I'm in. We have this incredible impact on the world. We are transformative. We change the world. And that's where I have the disconnect. How do you have these ambitions to transform and change the world if you're not willing to actually dive in there and try to understand, take apart the assumptions, rethink the world, rethink possibilities, maybe not to act, but maybe just to rethink about maybe where you shouldn't act? And these become philosophical questions. If you really want to transform, technology has been on, I mean, been on a run, I mean, to put it, you know, in a manner of speaking. And if we stop to think about, no one's going to challenge the impact. But if the question is just, all I'm concerned about is the impact without the understandings of the implications of the impact, or even the more basic questions we ask as people is, why? Why do we need this? You know, and to me, these do lead to kind of philosophical questions. So I'm absolutely with you. I could never disconnect these things. And one of the things, of course, you know, that I focus on a lot is these philosophies of technology, because philosophies of technology bring these two questions to bear. What does it mean to be in this world? And what does it mean to be in this world with technology? And if we're going to accept the fact that it's so literally changing on a global scale, arguably for worse than for better, where we don't understand and we will not understand, if we're not willing to go back and go and look at some of the motivations, assumptions, the things that not give us the answer, but guide us towards the questions and then what we make, it's just irresponsible.
Yeah, there's a lot of irresponsibility, a lot of irresponsibility rolling around out there.
Like, there's no doubt about that. Yeah,
that we seem to have in abundance. I want to start to get into the definitions and terms, but one of the sections of the book that really got me thinking, there are several of them, but this one, as I was like reading and writing, I was like, I should probably start here, even though you didn't start here. And because it kept coming back to me, this idea of knowing, you know, how do we know the world? And you break that down and start to talk about the God trick. One of the things is the God trick, which I want you to expand on. Yeah. And then landing on a place of situated knowledge that really stuck out to me, because I've spoken to, over the recent time of doing the show, some Indigenous scholars. And one of the things that they said, not to say that there's a universality to the way that world operates as a body of thought, but one of the things that I pulled out was this one woman, Jessica Hernandez, who wrote a book, Fresh Banana Leaves, which I highly recommend, mm-hmm. or listen to that episode for listeners if you haven't, is the fact that so much of Indigenous knowledge is place-based. And what she means by that is that, if I could share a little bit of her ideas, that her existence growing up as an Indigenous woman where she did, which was in Mexico and parts of Central America, is unique from the Indigenous experience of where she currently lives, which is in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Right. And the knowledge base and the sciences that came from those societies are very based in the area and the localities and the proximities of where they are. Mm. And so when I started to hear you write about how you know the world and this idea of situated knowledge, the two ideas started to connect, at least to me. So I wanted to give you an opportunity, independent of maybe the Indigenous stuff, because you might not have read her book or whatever, yeah. But you know, like, how do you frame that idea of knowing the world in relation to the God trick and then this situated knowledge?
Yeah, so great. All points to pick up on there. So I think that, and first of all, actually, I think there's a deep, so situated knowledge is and certain these terms, situated knowledge, and of course, and the God trick comes from Donna Haraway. And her cyber feminist, whatever, however you want to call her, but really understanding ideas of technology and biology in relation to what it means in the kind of feminist, how to know as a feminist, feminist epistemologies. Critical to that is this interdependency or relationality. We can only know things in relation to other things. And this directly connects actually to the Indigenous epistemology, of which, yes, there are diversity of ways of knowing. Let's not make the mistake of conflating them all into one way of knowing the world. But that idea that we gain knowledge through the relations of place, literally the things we're connected to, the trees, the land, the other non-human beings, more than human, et cetera, that's what constitutes place, and it's situated. And any claim to know is based on the relations you make of where you are. This is what Donna Haraway was talking about with situated knowledge, is that, first of all, any knower has to be there, has to be embodied, has to be in that world. Then secondly, that knowing comes from all of those relatedness to connected. It's a deep connection, but it is situated a place. And so this opens up to other thinking, you know, related to this, which is like pluriversal thinking, the idea of more than one world. And it's very important that one does not necessarily make the claim to a unit. So you make a claim because you're there and you understand the relation. So you can claim to know, but your knowledge may not be universal. It's a place. But collectively, when we know of various situations, when you look at knowledge, not as an individual thinker, but as collective thought, we start to have this wonderful woven mosaics of pictures that, and it may be fragmented, it may be a little distorted, but actually, you know, that sounds like, you know, the world that we are in, and you can connect these parts together. The opposite is exactly what Donna Haraway called the God trick, as if there was a play, which is, you know, that going back to much of the history of sciences and knowledge, is that this knowing of the absolute, this understanding of universality, as if there's a place in the world that you can know where you are literally above it all. You can see everything in one plane, you know, where it's not this fragmented view, but it's this whole view. That doesn't exist. And that's really what she argued, is that there is no God trick here. You can't, you know, when people make claims to valid knowledge or they make claims to truth, that's what she would call them on that. That's the God trick, right? So for me, if I say, when people make the argument, this is what design is, this is the way we have to design, these are the goals and values of design, and it is only these because we can validate them, or all our research has pointed in this direction. How do you know that? unless you're pulling a God trick. And maybe it's obscuring more than revealing. And one of the things that came back to this kind of ideas of the, I mean, much of also what I, the philosophies that I draw on, these feminist epistemologies, which are these kinds of, they're emancipatory, they're liberating, they're freeing. To me, as a designer, if I didn't have to think about the discipline of design, if I can think of a pluriversal, multiple ways of designing, that's pretty liberating, one. And two, I actually think given the challenges and how much we've kind of messed up in design, we need everything. You know, we need this pluriversality. We need this diversity of approaches. We need that more than we need to kind of reason that this is the only way and the best way to do something.
I want to go into at least two points that you said there, because that's also one of the things that really made me respond to your work. As someone who spends time doing a lot of stuff, but at least one of the things I do is this show, right? I get an opportunity to interview and talk to really interesting people, and then I branch out from their work into other work. Having said that, it's rarer to find, I'm discovering it more and more, but it is the fact that I have to discover it is what's making me think about it, right? That people who are thinking about so many of these spaces, whether it's design or maybe other disciplines, so very rarely include Indigenous perspective. They very rarely include feminist thinking. Mm-hmm. And so when people present to me as if they have authority, and I go to the footnotes and I don't see what I would consider diverse schools of thought, mm-hmm. I instantly am like less interested in what they have to say.
Yeah.
Right. And so I wonder what made that like a conscious decision to branch into like what you said, those more liberatory spaces, because, you know, I'm amazed at the things that I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. So it becomes like an active choice to seek them out. But I feel like just the way you're making an active choice, others are making an active choice to not give a fuck, yeah. Right? And not do those things.
Yeah.
So I want to get a sense of why that notion of liberatory spaces and exploring them was so important to this process.
Okay, great question. And I think there's sort of two answers. One is kind of practical. One is more, what would be the word? Ambitious, I guess. So, and then to get into the particular, so I also need focus, right? So for me, the focus was on this question of human-centered design and how human-centered design has come to define what we call the discipline of design. And then when people talk about what is good design or what we need to do in design, they're speaking from authority because they have credibility within the discipline or they have a position within the discipline. So, you know, the book says, I'm going to think past more than human-centered worlds and more than human-centered design. And there's different ways to do that. One is to go after the authority, unpack it. You know, I could spend the whole book critiquing the discipline of human-centered design. So I said, oh, that's not what I want to do. That's not, but, you know, and I don't want to have to, I want, and this is why I made the argument that I'm going to make a critical and creative speculation. Okay, I'm going to give you some reasons why I want to move past human-centered design. But give me the space to start being critical and creative about giving an alternative, right? Without having to do all the unpacking. I do some unpacking in more subtle ways and critiquing and so on. So that was the practical sense to say, I'm not going to do a design discipline. I created this term nomadic practices, that design is really, it's the disciplines are, they're authority driven. They're saying, this is the body of knowledge we have to take seriously. This is the foundation. The metaphor I use and why I arrived at nomadic practices, which is informed by philosophy, particularly Deleuze and Guattari, but this idea that if you think about disciplines, you can think of them as sedentary. They're fixed in a place. You say, this is our territory. We all talk about territories and disciplines. A lot of the job is actually then to build a wall around your territory and to discipline the territory, to say, this is what you have to do. This is how you behave here. This is what you have to say. This is how we progress. These are the this is the borders we have to protect, et cetera. That's how we are going to be good at our discipline. That is, first of all, you can spend all your time unpacking that. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to think past that. So that was one thing. But the really important part, the more urgent part, is we need a lot more than that. Again, it's like, you know, really, we think about, and again, going back to my point about trying to understand, the part of the reason why you might want to not, you want to think past human-centered design is you want to think past human exceptionalism, which is, and we could maybe, I'm sure we'll come back to it, ideas of humanism and enlightenment thinking. and Eurocentric thinking, that this is something that we clearly have to think past and get through and find different structures, not just to give a different talk, but structurally rethink them. Anyway, so this allows to this, that's why it was this move to this multiplicity. That's why it was the move to say disciplines are actually getting in the way. What we need is to allow as many, is to give, I was hoping, okay, to give the kind of space, not just for myself, but for others to make claims of what is designing and how, what they want out of designing, what are the values that they claim. This goes back to the situated knowledge from my place for, you know, my reality, for my culture, for my, and then in the collectivity of it and the diversity of it, we might be able to tackle some of the issues we're facing. That's a, to me, a far better way. Diversity is and multiplicity is a far better way to tackle a big challenge like climate crisis than literally building a fort.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another bad idea. We're building forts on shaky ground.
That's right. Exactly. Right. And you don't pay attention to the ground you're on. Even you pay attention to the walls you're building, you know?
Yeah. And there's incredible ways in which we hide those realities, right? And institutions, which was the second piece I wanted to get to a little bit, is, you know, institutions are part of the guarding of that knowledge, right? Like the notion of a university. And I wonder, you know, we herald back to, you know, the mystery schools of Egypt. You think about Timbuktu, the Library of Alexandria, and I'm like, has this been just part of our way of being in terms of the walled knowledge, those who are capable of knowing or anointed to know, versus a newer reality, perhaps, that opens up knowledge to everyone, right? I think that was maybe some of the nation beginnings of the internet, right? The ambition was that all this knowledge would be there. And now it's behind paywalls, right?
So, yeah.
and, you know, I'm landing there only because I'm going back to your thoughts about your students, right? Like you send them out into the world with these grand ambitions and reality somehow look different.
Yes.
So keeping all that in mind, like are the institutions as currently constructed prepared to have the sort of conversations that you are outlining in this book? And then we're going to get to more of the humanity stuff.
I like to think so. I mean, in the sense that I like to think of there's a plasticity to the way in which we collectively structure. And you do see, you know, you're seeing that. I mean, I think it's happening now in the sense that people are not just avoiding. I mean, it's like, you know, like John Dewey had an idea of there's politics with the big P, which is all of the institutions, you know, and all the governance structures. And then there's politics of the everyday. And our constant kind of shifting of actions, routines. And I think even we can think of the kind of collective actions and political actions that are distributed and shared and collective, I think are happening all the time in rethought. And you know, there's particular certainly within design about social enterprises, for example, is one collective structure of design. So absolutely, I like to think of that. However, though, I think, you know, that the point is, and where I was trying to go with this was, we will talk about humanism, but the very notions of the institutions that we've put in place are not only that, like there's some kind of overriding top-down logic that says this is the truth and we have to abide by the truth. Really, over the period of time, we've had this kind of sedimentation. We have these kind of, you know, material arrangements, which they almost start to set their own trajectory. You know, it's so hard to think past. Right now, we're caught in, I mean, whatever you want to call it, the institutional structures of capitalism, the institutional structures of the politics that we're in, you know, that is almost that feeling we have. It's hard to think out of and think through. But yet, you know, I do think that there is a lot of that happening. And in some ways, a small thing, but I think the responsibility to own up to the fact that, hey, I thought about the complicity of design in the kind of way in which we've led to the urgencies that we have. Well, you know, there's my own complicity as a design educator. I do need to rethink design education. I do need to rethink the structures. And it could be in that very practical hands-on sense, the classroom, the way in which we organize, what we consider, what gathers, and I talk a lot about that, what gathers and what we design, the situatedness of the way we learn, I think are really some concrete things that start to, maybe you could say, take apart institutions, but I like to think about the plasticity of the institutions. However, I do think there's deep structural thinking that has come from humanist thought and the Enlightenment era, which has worked its way sedimented throughout the very, I mean, it's hard for us even to think past and think through. But we do can at least look at it as a historical moment. And part of what you were suggesting at the beginning was there have, you know, there not to, I mean, when you get caught up in that historical timeline of progression, which is exactly what Enlightenment thinking is about, that in fact, no, we can go back. There has been nothing but constant rethinking and other structures by which we have learned, which have been as effective, if not more effective. You know, the past is not relish of something lesser than. The past is as much a future opportunity. And whatever we need is we need to be expansive. So I was trying to open some of that up in the book in the context of design. Design is so caught up in the trajectories of innovation and progression and progress. I mean, you know, it aside from all the other issues, I mean, it's hard not to see past that.
Yeah. And one of my questions is, it's so funny you brought up the progress point, right? Because literally one of my questions is like, is progress an illusion? Whether it's in a design perspective or otherwise, right? Because I think it ties so much to the capitalist notion that it's woven through all of this. Like I'm someone that people who listen to the show will hear me say this all the time. Like to me, the prevailing operating system, the global operating system is capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And everything, there's subsets of it. It might look different in different places. Like, you know, now I have new language, you know, it might be situated differently, right?
Yeah.
In different places, but we're all kind of chugging along in like the capitalist track.
That's right.
And it's very hard to have conversations out of it. Right. And when I say out of it, I'm not even talking about like capitalism versus socialism or communism, right? Because to me, that's the same conversation, right? Like if we're having this conversation and you're bringing up Marx to me, I don't care, right? Like, don't give a shit about that. So having said all that, are we trying to pull apart the prevailing growth story that capitalism needs in order to survive? Mm-hmm. It needs new territory, new cannon fodder, new frontiers, new whatever the fuck, in order to survive. And that is a story of progress for a few, doom for most, right? And so how do we pull apart the illusion thread, which design supports, while also dealing with this capitalism thread? Easy.
Yeah, exactly. And if I had the answer, I mean,
we wouldn't be on this show.
No, exactly. So I have thoughts. Okay. And yeah, that's
thoughts are welcome. I could use some.
Yeah. And I think the question, I mean, first of all, you know, on the progress question, I mean, you know, and you know this well, I mean, the question has to be changed to progress for whom? You know, sure, I have no problem with progress, but progress for whom? Who's making a claim to progress, and who wants progress? And I'm not of the mind that one person's progress is everyone's progress. And you know, we're in a world of contradictions. We are in a world of exclusions. But you know, let's have some mindfulness about this. Let's have some attentiveness to this. Let's work through some of these issues. And so, I think progress is fine. It's just progress for who? We can ask this question over and over. Now, of course, this is all in the face of this, as you mentioned. I mean, this kind of ideological infrastructure, this kind of massive material arrangements, which have been in the works for centuries, and has compiled, you know, literally. I mean, to me as a designer, I see the world as so material, is constantly these material arrangements. That's what designers do. We contribute to the material arrangements, and these material arrangements are as hard to get around as it is for, I have this large, where I'm in the studio right now, and I have this large table in the middle of the studio. I can't simply walk through that table. It's you know, and these things sediment, but they also, the table organizes people and organizes things and this certain thing, and there is this kind of directive. Now, having said all that, I think one of the questions that we look for, okay, so where do we have openings? You know, we can call them resistances, we can call them whatever. Where do we have openings, and how do we, you know, and this is where where the book ultimately goes to, I think, is something we don't pay attention to design. I've already mentioned is collective structures, but what I call constituencies, what I also called gatherings, that in order for us to think through progress for whom, values for whom, what do we think is good, and what is good for whom, and what do we mean by good, this is done in these collective structures, in this gatherings, and I include non-humans in the gathering. I want to have more than human understanding. Now, it has all kinds of issues, and we can talk about that. But I think that this, so, but when you, and I think this again is happening, and I think you see different arrangements. So I'll bring, so for example, and if you know the wonderful work by, so there's, you know, in design, related design, there's Arturo Escobar's, you know, design for the pluriverse. And mostly looking at South America and different ways of designing that are situated, much the way we talked about it. And I think this kind of, these pluriversal opportunities, whether it is in its diversity of strategies, that we can start to weave and knit together some things that we can transfer elsewhere, you know, or that, hey, that's just great, that works in that situation, you know, that works. Wonderful. Another wonderful book in the draw is Anna Singh's Mushrooms at the End of the World, and her idea of noticing. And she is in this kind of post-capitalist world. She does these ethnographies of Matsutake mushroom pickers, but Matsutake mushrooms, delicacy in Japan, you know, the story, and I'll just share it. But basically, they're post-capitalist in the sense, in the literal sense, that Matsutake mushrooms, it became this delicacy, but they grow in disturbed landscapes. So landscapes that have been deforested and are re-emerging, forests that are coming back, and Matsutake mushrooms really thrive there. But what she argued, what she points out, which is beautiful in her noticing, are the collective structures of this, all the more than human elements of place, of these particular landscapes, the things that come together, the pine, the spruce, the soil, the, you know, where these mushrooms grow, with them following the Matsutake mushroom pickers or foragers and how they create their own collective structures about trade and bartering. My point is that there are other material arrangements in the world, right? And I do think this is where we need to, it's not so much to, yes, it's to unravel, but part of that unravel is to, you know, unblur, to kind of, you know, the myopia, the kind of just the, I mean, as much as the everyday dangers of capitalism, the sheer extractive, exploitive nature of it, whether it be labor or whether it be the planet, it also obscures the world for us. It obscures opportunity. It's what Tony Fry talked about as defuturing. It actually delimits our futures. It doesn't create new futures for it. We, you know, you just said what the future is. The future is we're going to innovate all the time. We're always going to have new stuff. We're going to have endless resources, you know, and we're going to perfect convenience. You know,
be frictionless.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, and that is the future. So this defuturing is really the consequence, and particularly for design, that because design is so obsessed with the future, it happens to be obsessed with the future in many ways. I think in ways that are misleading and not as productive as they could be, because it's a promise of the future. It's going to resolve everything, like you said. It's frictionless. The future somehow is frictionless, despite what we face every day here in the present.
It's a mansion on a hill, right?
That's right.
the metaphorical mansion on a hill.
That's it.
But I want to get into this notion of posthumanism, because again, it is, I think you nail it when you live in a even people who are environmentalists or sustainability experts, you know, people who you would think are, you know, in it for the right, the quote unquote right reasons, still put humans on the top of the food chain, right? When I was growing up, in the 80s and stuff, I remember the big fight was, you know, foresters against like some kind of spotted owl or something. I don't even know where I read this, but somehow when I was a kid and the idea of a tree hugger came into the lexicon, at least for my lexicon in the 80s, it was presented to us that, you know, there are these forest, there's, you know, lumberjacks, these forest people, and they need to cut down these trees. And a couple of no account tree huggers that want to save some fucking owl or something are stopping the progress, right? Like they're gumming up the works. And that was one of my first introductions to this idea that somehow if humans need something, it doesn't matter what's on the other side of that, right? Whether it's a tree as a living part of a forest infrastructure or what the many creatures that inhabit that, regardless of just the owl or anything else, right? And so I still think that's a prevailing thought, right? That it would be nice, but you know, we kind of run this, don't we? Like, can't we just do what we want?
Yeah.
You know, another example, and this is a silly one, but I remember there was like this kid who fell into like a gorilla.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like enclosure, right? And everybody was like, "Eh, you got to save the kid." And I was like, "Do we?" You know, like, where were his parents? Like, how did he get there? Right? Yeah. Like, fuck. Right? Like,
and why are these gorillas in an enclosure? And why?
Yeah. Like, yeah. So we got to murder this gorilla because the kid wasn't listening to his parents. Yeah. Like, screw that kid. Yeah. You know, like, so is I'm making a joke, but not really. I was serious. Like, screw that kid. But it speaks to this dominance of us on top. Everything else is like, it's a nice to have if it doesn't affect us. And what you propose in the book in a far more eloquent, non-anti-kid way is...
No children are eaten in the book. This is
No children are eaten in the book. But it's thinking about these things in a very serious way differently, which I think cuts us very deeply because we've been programmed to think we're on top. Mm-hmm. So I want to give you an opportunity to kind of make those distinctions of how you're moving away from human-centered / humanity-centered, whatever language we use, to something that is post-humanist.
Okay, so great setup. And I think that the idea of, I mean, you know, thinking past, it's hard, of course, to think past this kind of human exceptionalism, but you nailed it in the sense that at the end of the day, no matter how much, and I'll come back to this, empathy we have for things that are not human, the final trade-off will be human. You know, it's not even much of a debate. I mean, you made that quite clear. And of course, but herein lies the problem, this notion of empathy, you know, that in fact already there is a human-centered construct about how we need to empathize with another being in order to care. And in fact, when you really look at the relations, and this is what the goal of post-humanism is, how we have these relations or interdependencies, these interdependencies are not built on empathy. You know, and this also goes to the heart of design, where I think a lot of this notion of human-centered design is we need to empathize with the user. Well, then the question arises, well, what of those that we cannot empathize with? What then of design, you know? And empathy is that very construct of a human-centered construct, and it's kind of and this becomes, you know, this is the classic imprint, whether you want to call it cognitive, psychological, you know, human bodily imprint that we're going to put on things that are not human, and so those frame the relations, and that's what we need to unpack, and that's what we need to think through, and redo. And so in the kind of world in which, you know, we are firstly, you know. Despite, okay, so what I lay out, and I do this often in my talk, so I do talk about humanism and how do we get on top of the pyramid is through the belief of breaking away from spiritual beliefs and so on, and whether they be pagan or whether they be kind of Christian, whatever it might be, that this idea that we need to determine our own destiny, that is human destiny, we need to rely on ourselves and we need to rely on human reasoning. Human reasoning, the perfection of human reasoning is what really is behind much of this idea of human exceptionalism. And then, it wasn't, you know, this sense that if we, because we are so exceptional, then we can take on care of the world. We deserve to be on top of that pyramid, whether we exploit it and extract it, which we normally do, but even in the environmental sense, we will be stewards of the world. That has not worked out so well. You know, that keeps us at the top of the pyramid. We are the stewards, and we are the ones to articulate what the dilemmas and what the problems are to focus on. So I think that challenge has been that we have to rethink. If you take these kinds of humanist principles and you think, well, you know, part of that, as you can see, this is working through the kind of binarisms of us versus nature, and nature needs to be tamed, nature needs to be, you know. And so these create the constructs of the way in which we reason in the world. All the while that that's happening, though, while we are so perfecting our place in the world, we've had the climate crisis. We've had the age of the Anthropocene. And the age of the Anthropocene, you know, and if you want to be, you know, simplest, it started the age of Industrial Revolution. It probably started before that. It actually aligned so well with human enlightenment. Our own inability to argue, be inclusive of what it was meant to be human. We know this from the very explicit exclusions of, you know, whether you're black, whether you're brown, whether you're indigenous. This was, you know, this was the same set of consequences that said, this is the way, A, that you need to be human, and only these people were part of what was being human. These are the consequences. And that we, but you know, going back to this kind of hubris of thought, the lack of humility to realize, to be so focused on what you think your role is in the world and what your place of action is in the world. Meanwhile, you create a world in which we have climate crisis in the age of the Anthropocene. We had no idea. The if anything, you go back to the notion of post-humanism. People often think post-humanism is, well, I'm not going to think about humans anymore. Humans are, you know, like, but we're going to displace them completely. The notion is it's about a sharing. It's about recognizing our very interdependency with things that are not human. It actually reflects back a rethinking of what it means to be human. So what does it mean to be human in a multi-species world? What does it mean to be human in a more than human world? What does it mean to be human when you are not in control because others that are not human have forms of agency themselves, have ways of affecting the world? A forest can perfectly manage and even manage through disasters of forest fires and anything else, as it has for millions of years, without us acting as agentic actors. It can thrive, so I think that in some sense it is just accepting the very condition of the world that we're in, unlike what humanism did, which was to exclude that. It's to look at the world and to understand that, you know, in it, if we have that less myopic, more expansive ways of thinking, that situated knowledge, that's attention to the relationships we have, attention to the interdependencies that we have, we see our place in the world with greater humility. But it actually, we're in the world that we truly are in, you know, and that's really the point. I mean, I think that, you know, in some sense, you know, post-humanism, the philosophy, has a really ambivalent relation to the word reality, and in part because reality has been a term that's been used to beat people over the heads about what is true and what isn't true.
Yeah.
And I think, a word around that is the condition. What is the condition that we're in? And then if you think through the condition, what then are the responsible ways of acting, or what is your role without fancy thoughts of reason about our place? And, you know, for me, so that's why when I came down to what was the way in which I could square that in thinking through what would be, what is the good? Mm-hmm. What is the good by which we should act? What is the good in design? I came to the term of cohabitation. The good is that we cohabit the particular world we're in. And we cohabit it well, you know, and that opens up to differences, that opens up to the kind of pluriversal that I was talking about, but it opens up to that relational thinking. So, you know, I think you do have to think, you know, going back to your, I mean, you know, poor child that ended up in the gorilla enclosure, but, you know, I do think, you know, we kind of have to rethink, you know, what exactly are those, the way in which we, the zoo. I mean, you know, you feel that it's palpable now. What is this world that we're cohabiting here?
Yeah.
What are it's we a, doing? It makes no
it's
sense.
It's a weird thing,
yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I would have, when I was a kid, I would have killed to go to SeaWorld, right? Like, if my parents had put on the table that we were going to leave Brooklyn and go to SeaWorld.
Yeah, absolutely.
My head would have exploded, right? It would have literally popped off my shoulders, right? And now, knowing what those places are, I my love of Shamu has turned into deep despair over Tillicum, right?
Like, absolutely,
I cannot shake that reality, right? And, you know, and that's the kind of the knowing of the world, right? Like, we learn these things, we want to experience these things, and then we end up this cycle of like making them worse, right? In efforts to save, right? So, you know, the very notion is that institutions like that will say, well, we're preserving these species, right? If it wasn't for these facilities, whether they're really, really good zoos, you know, San Diego, Bronx Zoo, really amazing zoos, right? Then these species will be gone, right? And I'm like, but aren't we not addressing the like thing that's making them gone in the first place? But I don't know, right? I'm trapped in this cycle.
So, you know, I mean, we moved to Vancouver. I didn't grow up here. And well, actually, now it's like 20 years ago, I moved to Vancouver. They have a wonderful aquarium, which is the Vancouver Marine Center. And of course, you know, we had kids and we'd bring them to the, you know, brought our kids to the Marine Center, and it was all about conservation and of course, and education, like how else could children in particular get so close to these animals? And then this gives, therefore, empathy, gives an appreciation.
Yeah.
Now, when I was a kid, And I remember, you know, I grew up in Montreal and my parents put us in a Volkswagen camper. We drove across the country and we ended up in Vancouver. And I was, it's like, you know, as a kid, like, yeah, we're going to go to what was called the Vancouver, I don't know if it was called Vancouver SeaWorld or Marine World or whatever. This is 1970s. And sure enough, the show was an orca pulling a dog on a surfboard.
Yeah.
and you know, and getting him a giant toothbrush and brushing the teeth of the killer whale. This was the same institution. And so, you know, what that shows is, which is fascinating, well, fascinating, hopeful. And you can see the evolution, you can see the change, you can see the constructions that are created and recreated. What is that institution? Oh, it's a place where of entertainment too. What is that place? You know, it was a freak show, really, right? Mm-hmm. And then it was, oh no, we're here to kind of like, you know, preserve and conserve. And then, no, we're here to educate. And these human constructions of thought that are constantly built around, and you know, we said before about ultimately a lot, at the very beginning, we talked about how there's a lot of irresponsibility going around. But if you actually look at the rationalizations, it's rationalizations of responsibility. Right, these constructions of thought. So this goes back to why, you know, why, how can we do, you know, this go back to the philosophy. This is where I think I'm trying to understand how things are constructed and that they can be reconstructed and they can be constructed anew, you know, and I think those that sense is kind of optimistic, but ultimately you run, but these places do run. I mean, right now the Marine Center, you know, in Vancouver, the aquarium, you know, it can't have, you know, whales, it can't have dolphins. I mean, you know, and the very reason for its conservation, the argument starts to implode a little bit. There's you know, and I think something we have to be responsible about that too. And I was just working with a group and they have this wonderful term of hospicing, mm-hmm. hospicing bad ideas, hospicing institutions. How do we bring these things to a careful end?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's willingness to kind of think through, admit that we were wrong and kind of go at it with a certain humility as we do at end of life. End of life, suddenly there's a whole lot of humility, you know, and generosity. I think this is a wonderful term, I talk about this a lot, and I use the term biographies, and thinking about not just this constant focus on designing the newness of things, just go focused on something new. We pay no attention to how something ends, mm-hmm. and a kind of challenge for designers to think about the endings of the things they make and to work from their endings.
And, you know, it's interesting that, again, this is just coming up because you mentioned this. Because when I look at your notion and others that you cite in the book is wonderfully filled with, like, talk about going into a ton of different tributaries just by reading this book. Like, it opens up, like, a lot of stuff,
thank
right?
You. Thank you.
You're welcome. I think it's great in that regard. But what comes to my mind is that the post-humanist frames that you've started to put together and provocations is a very profound way of reintegrating us as humans into the world that we inhabit. Mm-hmm. That's how I took it.
Absolutely.
And I juxtapose that with this sort of tech libertarian view of humanity, which is to further distance us into some sort of AI, AR, augmented reality world, which also to me extends into, like, it parallels with their fascination with life extension.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like how you're talking about hospicing, yes. and things coming to an end,
yes.
and us profoundly dealing with that. Mm-hmm. They seem to feel like they don't want to deal with the ends of things, right? So we're going to live forever if we can upload our consciousness into, yes. some bullshit.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
Like, I can't even get my phone to not autocorrect. But you're going to, like, upload,
that's right.
upload your, every time I want to write fuck, it becomes duck. But, you know, good luck with uploading your consciousness, yeah. right, dummy?
Yeah.
So, like, I know, again, this was just something that came up in this moment of conversation. Then I want to get to the final two segments,
yeah.
of the show, but I want to get your thoughts on that notion of your and others' idea of post-human being more connected and this other tech bro libertarian dummy, yeah. idea of moving away from that.
Okay, great. And actually, there is an intersection for some people. You think, you'd step back and they go, what do you mean by post-human? And you know, there's certainly theories and ideas around post-human that could probably that I also described as transhuman, and this idea of through technologies of literally leaving our biological bodies, you know, and finding other constructs, other substrates by which we can, as you say, upload our consciousness, and or we can so perfect what it is to be human through the technology and become part of that technology. And I actually say at the very beginning of the book that I am not at all interested in that, what I call afterbody, you know, after human. What I really want to deal with is the now, and I appreciate, you know, the kind of human condition of now. But this is also why I really focus on that idea of cohabiting. But there's absolutely this whole trajectory, it works down to the tech browser, works down to Elon Musk launching his Tesla into, you know, into space, but then this play that we are going to, you know, colonize some planet, down to this kind of deep, ongoing, theoretical, technological move to disembody and ultimately to displanet and to desituate. And I think that's, you know, the better ways to describe it, but have been wrapped around notions of progress and human well-being. And yes, it's a big trick. And I think that whole notion, yeah, is so misguided. And I think that there, you know, sometimes you begin to wonder, is it the goal to be this kind of like, we're going to save humanity by literally, you know, colonizing another planet? Or is that the value, like, that we're going to, you know, achieve some sense of greater sense of well-being and self is really what the argument is in capitalism and marketing. I mean, that's what that's all about. Is that just simply the argument to maintain the means to do what we're doing now? Keep going with the technology, keep creating new technologies, new markets. You can invert the argument, really. This is, the goal is not that. The goal is to keep going with the technology, you know, that we've been, the technology trajectories. And this is just a rationale, an argument to keep doing that. This is why I come back to cohabit. So, and one of the, you know, I think that, no, our role, there's enough complications, there's enough challenges, enough contradictions. There is the very reality and urgency an existential challenge of being on this small strip of the planet that we inhabit, which is what Bruno Latour calls his critical terrain or critical zone limit, which is maybe, and I'm going to get some of the numbers wrong, it is maybe, you know, 200 meters underground, maybe 300 meters underground, and then up to, you know, into the atmosphere. This is the biosphere that we actually inhabit. This is what we have to cohabit. This is what we have to tend to, the interdependencies, tend to the, we're not going to blast off into space. This is the place we have to attend to. And this is where I think, this is where the post-human thinking of the relationality with the world brings that all into focus. I will go, you will go, humans will go the way of that strip around the planet. That's simply it. That's the climate crisis we're in.
Absolutely. You know, I feel like I've seen something similar, and then I'll get to Off the Dome and the Drop, which was talking about like the ludicrous nature of these people who think we're going to go to Mars. And, you know, I purposefully called these folks dummies because I feel like when we kind of give their ideas like some sort of like intellectual heft, like, I'm like, no, you're a fucking idiot, right? Like, I'm not even going to entertain your notion that even to go in a space station, we have to carry so much stuff to make that experience, which is not like this experience at all, right? They're floating around. They got to carry soil and oxygen, all kinds of stuff, just to float.
I mean, look at it two ways. Either in its abstract, in the fantasy, it is a non-relational world. Yeah. It's exactly as you say. Here I am floating, blah blah blah. In the material world, when you like, what is the current NASA project that now the launch has been moved off to November, which is eventually what the thing is, which is going to to build the infrastructure on the moon so they can launch.
Yeah, I think the Artemis launch or something like
that. The Artemis launch. Exactly that. The material relations you have to pack in a bloody rocket. And the challenge of that, you know, but yeah.
To do the least.
Yes. To do the least. Right? Yes. The least possible. Yeah.
Do the least possible.
Yes. And, right. And, but yeah, Yeah, I mean, it's
crazy.
Well, I guess it is crazy, but I guess where the craziness really starts to kind of like settle in is like, as you said, you got to call them dummies because this is taken seriously.
Yeah.
This is a
call it imagination capture.
Yeah.
Right. It's just, they suck so much oxygen out of the room with their stupidity.
Yeah.
That we can't do anything else.
No. Right? But this is, I mean, and it goes back, which I think that, you know, that, so Tony Fry's notion of defuturing, this is it.
Yeah.
They literally colonized the future, have occupied the future. This is what we should be thinking, you know, I think for me, the question is, what are all, you know, it's a sandcastle, like you said earlier, you know, I mean, it's like to get that, like to do, I literally tweet, this is what the future is. We're going to Mars, you know, what are all the assumptions that thing is built on, that thought can be carried to the degree it is. And it's not so much, you can go after the thought, but you can also start picking apart all those assumptions.
Yeah. And that's what we need to do. We got to call these dummies out. So on that note, putting the dummies aside,
yeah,
I want to get to Off the Dome, okay, which is, I actually only have one question, okay, right? Because I had a couple of others, but I don't really like them. Okay. Now that we've had like this really cool conversation, I don't want to muddy the waters with like my silly questions, but I did have one that still fits. You know, you mentioned your students quite a few times, and I had this question originally. What's a piece of advice that you give to your students that you know that they won't take in this moment, but you wish they would?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, well, and part of the, so there, it's actually pretty cliched. And I think you can understand though, why they won't, because they're just not prepared for it. But I think why they won't. So literally, okay. So the advice I would give is actually, you know, you think about, when I look at my students, I look in design and what motivates somebody to get a design. This motivation, this belief, this construction of a belief about what designing can do, which precedes getting into school. And what happens, of course, you get into school, then you're actually trained to what you should believe, what the motivations are. My advice is to go with that original passion, to go with that motivation. You know, you, there is something, because design is not something you get. I mean, this is particular design, and this design students again. It's not something in high school. It's not like biology class. You don't get it. Most people don't even understand what the design is even a thing. But when they do, and I know it was with me, the light goes off, and then you, as most people are, they're motivated by something by which they believe gives them place and a place of value in the world. And that's what gets lost, is that place of value. And cultivating that place of value and starting. It's not to say you may be wrong. I mean, you know, it could be like, listen, all I want to do is like, I want to be able to afford a BMW when I get out of here and I hear there's a good job here. But still, you know, even then to face that that very place of value of one of kind of like, you know, capitalist consumerism, and to say, and we all know where that goes in the end in terms of what it actually, the returns on that, you know, when you achieve that. That's what I think can kind of get lost, because the main issue for many, and this is not just this for research, this is for for learning, being, acting in the world, is what one needs is you need to negotiate the world, you need a compass. But this compass is when you cultivate. The points of reference are your own. And you may be constantly rebuilding that compass. But they're looking at me as the teacher and saying, tell me what I should, they're not really, but you know, it's sort of like, how should I think? What should I think? What is good and what is bad? And I'm telling them, they already know what is good. That's what they don't want to hear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's awesome. That is I'm glad I scrapped the other two Off the Dome questions and just stayed with that one, because it's much more keeping with this conversation. The final segment of the show is called The Drop. And The Drop is where we recommend anything at all to my listeners. It can be one thing, it could be several things. I'll go first. I want to recommend the works of an author that for some reason in high school, I became like fascinated with reading everything by this person, which is going to sound like left of field relative to where we've been talking about. But his name is Thomas Hardy, and he's a Victorian writer, wrote quite a few books, many of which I read. So that's why I didn't want to just say one of them, because they all were good in different ways. He read Tessa de Duberville's Jude the Obscure, The Mayor of Casterbridge, Far From the Maddening Crowd, you know, there and others, right? But those are just a few that come to my mind that I don't know how I fell into this Thomas Hardy rabbit hole. I've subsequently have never looked up anything more about him other than his books, because I'm sure someone's gonna write to me telling me like Thomas Hardy was a complete asshole. You should read this essay where he said this about somebody. I'm sure he probably did. I have no idea. I'm gonna cop to saying all I did was read his work.
Yeah.
I don't know shit about his ideas, but he was a white dude in the 1860s and 70s yeah. and 80s. I'm sure he was a racist, yeah. right? But the books are awesome, yeah. right? Maybe he wasn't, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
You know, yeah. any white dude from that time with that sort of like mustachioed look and some sort of like collared, round arched collar, likely yeah. a racist, yeah. right? Yeah. So, but the books are really good about the human experience from a particular point of view. So I highly recommend them. So that's my drop.
Ah, okay.
So you're up.
Ah, okay. Actually, great. I had a Flaubert. That's my equivalent. I was really into Gustave Flaubert and like Madame Bovary. I was one of the people that would own up to like really like Madame Bovary. But that's not my drop. Okay. So actually, I kind of have two for you. So my first one, actually, one I just finished. It actually goes back to our discussion about Forrest. So Suzanne Simard's book on finding the mother tree. So Suzanne Simard is actually a biologist. She's actually here in Vancouver, University of British Columbia. She was, if anyone has ever heard the term, World Wood Web. So the idea that she wasn't the first to argue that plants, trees communicate to each other, and they communicate to each other through fungi. And through this, and she actually started off as a forester. She was in the, she, that was her, and looking at why the plants that were being, after they clear cut, and then they would plant the saplings and they wouldn't grow. And she noticed that the soil didn't have mycelia, didn't have fungi, and made this connection. And there's a wonderful set of experiments, and I love it because it's like, how do you talk to trees? How do you talk to fungi? Mm-hmm. And this is something which I talk about in my book about how do you talk with things that are not human? How do you get them to participate? But the book is actually a biography. It's an autobiography. It's beautifully written. But really just shows this relationality, shows, of course, that if anyone, another, I guess I'll throw it aside one, which is, if you ever read Richard Powers' Overstory, another beautiful book, and actually about trees. In fact, she is a character in Overstory. She inspired a character in Overstory. And really one of the keys that comes back to some of what we're talking about is the predominant notion of trees and plant life is one, and nature in general was one of competition. They're all competing. All these different species are competing with each other for resources. And what she shows is cooperation across mm-hmm. species. And again, thinking, reconstructing the model. And this is actually having a big impact now on ideas in biology and ecology. Okay, so that's my one drop. So Suzanne Simard's. The second one, which relates to some of what we actually talked about earlier, is great you brought it up, but think about indigenous epistemologies and the differences between them. But it relates to this kind of post-human kind of relational way of thinking. This is an article. It's called Making Kin with Machines by Jason Edward Lewis, Noelani Arista, Archer Pechawis, and Suzanne Kite. And it was in 2018. And it's addressing, it's kind of a little bit, it's the indigenous scholarship, indigenous epistemology, push back in some ways on ideas of kind of this relationality and post-humanism and multiplicity. Does it in this wonderful, they have these, as I mentioned, the co-authors, they each, their voices stay intact. They each write parts of the article. And so it keeps some of that polyvocality, that kind of that we would want to see, that diversity, which is really wonderfully in keeping with indigenous epistemology. It shows the differences across indigenous epistemologies, but it makes me reflect back on how much in my tradition of research and science, the Western tradition, we co-author all the time, but we write as if this collective voice of wisdom, this one voice, you know, mm-hmm. as if we resolve our thought and we don't really allow the differences between the co-authorship to come through. But it's actually a wonderful work of indigenous scholarship, contemporary indigenous scholarship, really relevant, that addresses the issues that we were just talking about in terms of post-humanism.
Those are wonderful drops. Yeah. I actually read Suzanne Simard's yeah. book last year because I was angling to have her on the show.
Oh, fantastic.
And yeah. I got close, but then it didn't happen. So if you're listening, Suzanne,
Yeah, you got to let them know that this is the drought.
Yeah, feel free to come on the show because her work has been very inspirational to me and many others.
Yeah.
I interviewed Adrienne Marie Brown as well, and she talks about her work. Like, there's a lot of people out there trying to talk about the connectedness of things, the fractal nature of things.
There's Merlin Sheldrake's book on fungus.
Like, I think her work in particular has transcended out of the space it started and is coming into like social science spaces, which I find very interesting. So these are awesome drops. So
great.
I really want to thank you for being on the show with me. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed having you on, and thanks so much for being a guest on The Deep Dive.
Yeah, thanks. And it was a true deep dive. I really appreciate your attentiveness to reading the book and the questions and just keeping that discussion going. But this has been wonderful. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.